You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, a special edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute, showcasing physics of information.
We hear from researchers who are studying information
to work out what happens when you fall into a black hole,
to discover the quantum building blocks of space and time,
to create an artificial space-time from quantum squids,
to describe how gravity generates time's arrow,
to define what life is,
to uncover whether reality is really real,
to develop a new discipline of quantum thermodynamics,
and to find out what information actually even is.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to this special edition of the podcast, taking a look at some of the research funded by the Foundational Questions Institute. In 2013, FQXI gave out over $3 million to researchers to investigate physics of information. Today, Zia and I are taking a look at what they have discovered.
First up, what happens if you fall into a black hole? Do you get stretched into spaghetti or burnt to a crisp? Over the past few years, this has become one of the most profound puzzles for those studying how quantum mechanics combines with general relativity, calling both these great theories into question.
Until fairly recently, physicists were pretty sure they knew what would happen by thinking about the rules of Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. Once you pass the black hole's event horizon, which marks the boundary beyond which not even light can escape the black hole's clutches, there's no going back. But even though you would be doomed, you wouldn't even know anything had happened. At least not at first.
No, the event horizon was thought to be a pretty uneventful place. But as you start to move closer to the black hole's core, you would start to feel its effects. The core's immense gravity would tug at your feet more than your head, and you would be stretched out like spaghetti before being ripped apart.
Indeed, for decades, spaghettification was thought to be the leading cause of death by black hole. That is, until FQXI members Don Maroff and Joel Polchinski, with two of their students, Ahmed Almeri and James Sully, made a startling discovery a couple of years ago, which suggested something quite different, and altogether more fiery. The firewall paradox is intimately tied to the fate of information falling into a black hole. In the 1970s, Stephen Hawking showed that black holes don't just sit around forever. They slowly evaporate, giving out radiation. But this raised a problem. What happens to the information about all the stuff that the black holes had swallowed up? According to the laws of quantum mechanics, this information can't just vanish from the universe.
Physicists had more or less settled on the idea that the missing information was somehow encoded into the Hawking radiation being given off by the black hole. But when Maroff and company took a closer look at how exactly this information was smuggled out, they hit their paradox.
The one-sentence summary of the firewall issue is, if quantum theory is correct, the black hole's event horizon is actually replaced by a firewall, waiting to fry any unsuspecting astronauts as they fall through. Worse still.
Worse than being burned alive?
Oh, much worse. If firewalls exist, this also means our understanding of general relativity is wrong. General relativity tells us that the event horizon is a mundane, non-fiery place that a falling astronaut would not distinguish from some other part of space. Alternatively, if general relativity is correct and the event horizon is firewall-free, then quantum theory must be wrong. I spoke with Maroff earlier and he told me about how surprised everyone was to learn that black holes might actually be surrounded by a giant ring of fire.
You know, I thought a lot of people would find it interesting, but I really didn't have a conception of how much impact it was going to have. It's very close to things that were said before. I mean, it's a refinement and it builds on a, you know, huge wealth of experience. But it targeted certain specific proposals that were intended to resolve the black hole information puzzle. And to my mind, it once again emphasized to everyone, maybe to a new generation of physicists, how complicated and subtle the problem really is, and that there are, you know, the fixes people had in mind certainly don't work in a simple form.
Meroff and company have since looked into various suggestions for resolving the paradox, usually by modifying either general relativity or quantum mechanics. But he found that all attempts so far are lacking.
The ones that were perhaps most intriguing, or maybe most bold, I should have said, were ones that proposed that you should modify quantum mechanics in various ways to resolve the puzzle. What was interesting about these proposals is they suggested that you could have one's cake and eat it too, that you could make modifications of quantum mechanics that somehow no one would ever notice. That was the idea. Or that were so small that even as a matter of principle, they couldn't be seen by any actual physical observer. And, well, it turns out that on closer examination, that's just not the case. So Joe Polchinski and I wrote another paper showing that, in fact, there was a sense in which they had to be really large. If you constructed the right experiment, it would show you massive violations of standard quantum mechanics. So, you know, that's not to say that the real world doesn't work that way. I don't know what happens if you fall into a black hole. Something weird has to happen. Maybe you do see large violations of quantum mechanics. But it again proves the point that something rather dramatic has to happen, at least if you look for it the right way.
So can physicists ever hope to resolve the firewall paradox? Or is it all hopeless?
Well, I asked Meroff whether he thinks any of the suggested resolutions so far might be, shall we say, fixable. He gave a diplomatic answer.
Showing that something is physically wrong without an experiment is not possible. So from that point of view, I'm not sure anything is a dead end. Any one of them could actually be right, unless it actually predicts something for an experiment or observation we've done that hasn't been seen. But I don't see anything out there which is both sharp enough to comment on and looks promising to my mind in terms of suggesting a way that everything could work out and make people, you know, generally happy.
This has become such a huge and confusing issue that quite a few of our grant winners have been looking for solutions, often using ideas from quantum information. I asked Meroff about the direction he will take next.
So the strategy that I'm following now, and I think it's true of a lot of people actually, is, uses sort of a military analogy, we're trying to perform a flanking maneuver. You know, we're trying to investigate problems that seem like they might be related that would give us new tools to attack the black hole information problem. A popular one right now, and the one that I'm also looking at, is looking at what's called holography, or gauge gravity duality, or the ADS-CFT correspondence, and trying to just understand, where does space-time come from? I mean, let me put it this way. Actually, I'm going to quote my collaborator, Joel Polchinski, who likes to say that the issue is not to explain where a firewall comes from, that the firewall seems like the natural thing you should get out of emergent space-time. In other words, it's just garbage. And the problem is to explain where the rest of the space-time outside the black hole comes from. So we're sort of taking that approach now, trying to understand in general, where does space-time come from? What deeper structures is it attached to? And in particular, following up leads that have emerged over the last 10 years, linking the structure of space-time to the theory of quantum information, because this is fundamentally an information theoretic problem in terms of the black hole information.
So there we have it. The firewall paradox holds strong and continues to perplex physicists. Thank you to Don Meroff for chatting with Brendan. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, I'm linking to previous interviews with physicists Niyash Afshoori and Carlo Rovelli, and some articles about firewalls and other black hole mysteries.
As Meroff said, although physicists have yet to find a way out of the paradox, one promising avenue is to examine the relationship between space-time geometry, in particular wormholes or tunnels in space-time, and quantum entanglement, which links particles separated by large distances. Some physicists have found a new equivalence between these two different ideas, and that could help create an escape route of information from a black hole that does not defy quantum mechanics.
Someone who has been looking at the connection between quantum entanglement and space-time geometry for many years now is large grant winner Mark Van Ramsdonk of the University of British Columbia. I want to highlight his project because he's not only examining how this idea might solve the firewall paradox, but also looking into whether it can explain the origin of space-time itself from quantum roots.
Back in May 2014, Van Ramsdonk spoke about his quest to reporter Karine Pikema. He has been thinking about an aspect of physics called holography, which enables physicists to translate descriptions of gravity in three dimensions into quantum processes in two dimensions. This had led some physicists to think that the 3D reality we see around us could be some kind of hologram of information stored in two dimensions, as he explained to Karine.
If you're sitting in front of your computer playing some three-dimensional video game, there's this universe that you're moving through and lots of things are happening in that universe. And it seems pretty real, but of course, fundamentally, all of the information about what's happening in your video game world is stored somewhere in your computer. So there's this memory card in your computer somewhere. The memory card is like the two-dimensional system where every state of that system would correspond to the higher dimensional world. So the question now of translating the lower dimensional system into the higher dimensional system, it's sort of like if someone handed you this computer and said, well, here's the video game, and actually everything that you see is really stored on this memory card. It wouldn't be at all necessarily obvious how the information of the 3D world and the video game is stored in the 2D memory card.
But just how is that information encoded? Van Ramsdonk's research has taken him a step further to make the leap that space-time geometry could in fact emerge from quantum processes, in particular entanglement, which links together distant particles. His calculations show that breaking apart entanglement in the 2D description of reality causes a space-time fabric to tear in the 3D description. Quantum entanglement could thus be the glue that binds space-time together.
So if we take that analogy with the computer almost literally, it would be saying that someone hands you this memory chip that they tell you is what's encoding the information about your video game. And what you realize is that, well, this memory chip is actually part of a quantum computer. It's storing the information about your higher dimensional world using this quantum entanglement. This is a central question that I'm focusing on, just trying to understand better how this works. So eventually the big plan is to continue trying to understand as best I can how this correspondence works, and then try to make some of these generalizations to more realistic gravitational theories.
You can listen to Mark Van Ramsdonk's full interview with Karine Pikema on our May 2014 podcast. I'm posting a link to that and to an article about his work by reporter Nicola Jones on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
So many of these ideas about ripping apart space-time and what happens in a black hole lie beyond the scope of experiments. Ideally, physicists would love to study such conditions in the laboratory, but due to the large amount of gravity needed, it's impossible to produce such environments on Earth. Even the multi-billion-dollar particle accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider, cannot create these conditions. However, a couple of our large grant winners have come up with ingenious ways to mimic such cosmic conditions in the laboratory for a fraction of the cost of a particle accelerator. One project I want to highlight is by Soren Parowanu of Aalto University, whose team is showing that it may be possible to model extreme space-times in the lab.
I met with Parowanu earlier this year at a conference in Arice, Italy. He and his colleagues have built an analog space-time from a metamaterial. That's a new type of material that's made up of tiny components, in this case superconducting circuits called squids. He explained to me how each component can be individually tuned so that the metamaterial as a whole can mimic the effects of a curving spacetime.
That's right. Our spacetime is in fact an artificial spacetime. It's an effective spacetime that is felt by the fields that propagate in media. And the magic is coming from the strength of the electromagnetic field. The gravitational field is much weaker, but in the lab, because the electromagnetic field is so strong, we actually can bend this effective spacetime in a much more effective way. We don't need to go to extremely high fields. We just need to use the electric fields that you would normally use anyway in a laptop.
And so when it is all up and running, you know, what will be the sort of the first things that you plan to test, and how will that relate to our understanding of quantum theory combined with the general theory of relativity?
One idea would be to create a situation that would mimic the inflation in the early universe, in which the space-time rapidly expands. And then we should see the creation of photons in our case. In the inflationary model, it's matter that is created and also photons. But that would be one of our first experiments to do, and we are probably not very far from that.
That was Soren Parawanu. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to an article by Nicola Jones about Soren's experiments, and you can also listen to Zia's interview with him in full on our September 2014 edition, also linked to on the podcast page.
Now, moving forward, next up is a project by Julian Barber, Flavio McCarty, and Tim Kozlowski. At least, I think it's next up, unless it's before and we're going backwards.
Next or before, how can you get the past and the future mixed up? The arrow of time only points in one direction.
Well, that's actually exactly why I've picked out this project to highlight, because these grant winners have come up with the mind-blowing idea that at the Big Bang, two mirror universes were created back-to-back with arrows of time that point in opposite directions, one running forwards and one running backwards. And this was one of the most popular projects of the grant round, and it made headlines around the world. Plus, it's wonderful to hear from Barbara again, who always raises the tone of the podcast. I interviewed Barbara for the September edition of the podcast last year, and he used Roman mythology to describe his back-to-back universe model to me.
So it was suddenly like the Roman god Janus, who looks in two ways at once. There is a central point, and in both directions, it looks the same. If you say time is moving in the direction in which structure is growing, then on either side of this Janus point, the middle of the two heads of Janus, you will say time is pointing in opposite directions and time is growing. That's the direction in which time is increasing. And really everything we've been doing has followed from this realization.
Barber used the image of the Roman god Janus, which has two faces pointing in opposite directions, one to the future and one to the past, to represent the idea of two universes growing in opposite time directions from the Big Bang, or the Janus point. But Barber also uses this model to explain how the arrow of time arises thanks to gravity. Here he is explaining to Zia how the direction of time's arrow is set by the force of gravity between matter in the early universe and how he discovered his back-to-back universes.
The paper that came out yesterday in Physical Review Letters is just about this idea of thinking about the arrow of time being defined by gravitational creation of structure. It goes back to a long-standing interest. I've been interested in the question of the arrow of time as long as I can remember. So it's always been at the back of my mind. And the paper most recently came out of, actually, Flavio and I decided we needed to make a grant application 2.5 years ago. And in making that grant application, just one idea occurred to me, which has really been key to all of the later developments, was, you see, the basic laws of Newton and Einstein are time reversal symmetric. They don't distinguish between the direction of time. And normally, particularly when you think about a gravitational system, they start with, shall we say, a fairly uniform distribution of particles in gravity, a fairly uniform state, and then they notice that the uniformity disappears, it tends to clump. This is called the genes instability, and it leads to what people call anti-thermodynamic behavior of gravity. It has negative specific heat. If you take energy out of an ordinary system, its temperature goes down. If you take energy out of a self-gravitating system, its energy goes up. The thing that finally occurred to me, I mean, I'd been very close to this idea for a long time, but it was in the talking to Flavio about things. But in the process, it led me to say, well, what happens if instead of just following the instability as it gets hotter and hotter, we reverse the arrow, the direction in which all the particles are going, and seeing what happens? Well, what we've realized is that then as you go in the opposite time direction, the system gets even more uniform, and then it passes through a very special point, and as it comes out the other side, it also goes into this situation where it's getting hotter, and it's symmetric on the other side.
So let me ask you, is this a mathematical result, or is it something that you're saying physically happens, that if you have a big bang, you know, we might find ourselves in one universe where we think time is going forward, but at the same time, another universe must be created to kind of balance out the symmetry. Is that just something that's a mathematical result, or does this actually happen?
The key thing is to take the law seriously and say the law is correct. And then it's just, at least in the Newtonian theory, it's an inescapable consequence of the law. It's a delight for us. Nobody seems to have thought of this before, and we stumbled on it by accident, you know. It's nothing like having to write a grant proposal.
That was Julian Barber. His idea about the origin of time's arrow is controversial. Most physicists identify the arrow of time with the direction in which entropy, or disorder, in the universe increases. Barber argues that the arrow of time should be identified with the direction in which complexity increases in the cosmos. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can read more about that in an article by Kate Becker. And there's also a link to the podcast from September last year, where you can hear Zia's full interview with Barber and one of his co-authors, Flavio Mercati.
Now, I know what's coming next. Based on my interaction with the environment thus far, I can infer that the next item will be about a research project funded by the FQXI Physics of Information grant.
That's uncanny. Yes, this ability to process information about our environment and make predictions based on it about the future, called predictive inference, is something that FQXI grant winner Susanna Still has been studying in detail. I've chosen to highlight this project because it shows just how far-reaching the implications of studying information at a foundational level can be. Still's goal is to come up with a definition of what life is based on ideas about information. Back in November 2014, she told reporter Corinne Pikema about how animals and other living organisms processing information must trade efficiency for speed in order to avoid danger.
The core question is, how does predictive inference come to bear on the fundamental physical limits of energetic and information processing efficiency? So can we do better? Can we push things to the ultimate limits if we process information in such a way that we pull out predictive parts? And in particular, we want to focus on a trade-off between efficiency and speed. So efficiency is just one side of the coin, because processes can be made efficient when they're running very, very slowly. But biology can't afford to wait long times. Or in other words, if I could figure out with a very high accuracy that tiger over there is going to eat me, but it would take me a very long time to figure that out, then that tiger over there would eat me. So I need to figure that out quickly, but I might not be able to figure it out to like the greatest precision of all in the time given.
In the case of a human running from a tiger, it's pretty easy to see that the organism in question, the frightened human, is alive. But telling living things apart from inanimate objects gets harder when we zoom down into smaller biological scales. Here's Still again.
So it's very easy for me to convince you that an organism would make some kind of prediction so that it can use them to accomplish something and have some advantage over other organisms. But some current research in neuroscience shows that parts of an organism can do that too. So if you take parts of the brain and you study them, you can find that some neurons or some neuronal circuits also seem to be doing some kind of predictive inference. But then you can go further and ask, how small can I go and still find systems that implement predictive inference? Does the machinery of life do something that smart on every scale?
Still argues that predictive inference could be the core concept that helps us identify intelligence and defines life itself.
The more exciting thing, I think, would be this view, you know, like about life. I don't want to go back to the old belief that living matter is like fundamentally different from non-living matter. But still, there's this mechanism of self-organization, and then once systems sort of like self-organize and the whole becomes more than the parts, then on a macroscopic level, you can definitely tell apart living systems from non-living systems, just intuitively, right? And so really what we want to get at is, you know, in what sense are they different? And they must be different in an information processing sense, right? But I would find it fascinating to see whether small-scale components of living systems are doing something like predictive inference. Doing predictive inference is an act of intelligence. So they would basically, by means of just running their dynamics, they would be doing something incredibly intelligent. If it's true that the way in which living systems differ from non-living systems is by means of the efficiency with which they process information and thereby also energy, then that would give us a whole different way of defining what it means to be alive.
You can hear Suzanne Still's full interview with reporter Corinne Pickamer on the November 2014 edition of the podcast, linked to on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. You'll also find a link to Corinne's article profiling Still's work in more detail.
We're giving you a lot of clips from various interviews in this edition, and we hope you'll go back and listen to the full interviews again. But be careful of the order that you play them in. Your decisions may alter reality.
What are you talking about, Brendan?
Well, sometimes the order in which you do things can change the outcomes of experiments, at least at the microscopic quantum level, if not really at the macroscopic podcast level. We often say that according to quantum theory, the results of an experiment to measure the property of a particle isn't set until you make that measurement. But even more than that, the order in which you make independent measurements can affect the results. It's the equivalent of stepping on a scale to measure your weight and finding that as a result, something that should be completely unconnected, like your eye color, changes. To borrow a nice analogy from one of our reporters, Kate Becker.
Ah, yes. This is quantum contextuality, another perplexing property of quantum mechanics, which some suggest could be used to power quantum computers so they perform at superfast speeds. And the idea is that it's not just the measurements that you make that affect the outcome of your experiments, but the order in which you make seemingly unrelated measurements too. The standard interpretation of quantum theory explains this ability of particles to return seemingly unpredictable results, which change depending on how you make the measurements, by saying that until the measurement is made, the particles have no set properties. Instead, it's only in the instant that you ask the particle a question that the particle settles on one answer, almost on a whim. Reality is created by the act of your making measurements.
But that's not the only way to interpret what's going on. It could be that particles are pre-programmed with a set of instructions that tell them what answers to give, depending not only on what questions they're asked, but also the context of those questions.
So it's the equivalent of your eyes being programmed to look blue if you choose to weigh yourself before you look in the mirror.
But to look brown if you choose to look in the mirror before you weigh yourself.
That would involve a very complicated set of instructions, if you take into account that there could be a myriad of other bathroom activities you carry out before looking in the mirror to check your eye colour.
Yes, but we don't need to go into my bathroom routine in such detail. right now.
No, sorry, of course not, Brendan. Anyway, earlier I spoke with one of our large grant winners, quantum physicist Arden Cabello of the University of Seville, who put these ideas about contextuality and the nature of reality into, well, context.
And that is when the big question comes is, okay, why? And there are two answers to that. Is okay, one possibility is that simply nature has predefined answers, but these predefined answers depend on the context, depend on the set of measurements you perform. This is nice, but this is not really so exciting. What is really exciting is the other possibility, is that nature doesn't have these answers, and nature creates an answer just when you ask a question. And despite of that, that suggests that everything should be chaotic. Despite of that, we have a beautiful order, which is encapsulated in quantum theory. So, and you can use this to make computers and to do secure communications and so on. So, on one hand, foundationals is exciting because I'm touching the universe, I'm touching the bones of the universe, and also I have the ability to use this magical things to do practical stuff.
That was Arden Cabello. So he clearly prefers the standard quantum way of thinking about things, the idea that reality is created when we make observations. But is there any way that he can prove that this interpretation is better than the possibility that particles are pre-programmed with complicated instructions? Or is it just a matter of taste, which you choose?
This is something Cabello has been researching as part of his grant, by looking in a surprising direction, at thermodynamics, the science of heat and energy transfer. You see, it turns out that information doesn't come for free in the microscopic world. Storing and processing information produces heat. And if we want to argue that particles are pre-programmed with a huge set of instructions that allow it to return different answers depending on the context of the measurements made on it, then we should expect that it must have a huge capacity for storing and processing these instructions. That, in turn, would generate a huge amount of heat that should be noticeable in experiments, but which has never been seen. Cabello explains.
Now, recently, we discovered that if you want to understand quantum contextuality, the way quantum systems produce contextuality, then you have two options. One option is you use a classical system with a lot of memory. The other option is you don't have such a thing. You have just an entity that produces outcomes. But we notice that in the first case, if the memory of the system is limited, the system, in order to produce the quantum results, should produce also heat every time it's measured. Actually, the prediction is it should produce infinite amount of heat, and you don't see such a thing on the lab. Meaning what? Most likely, meaning that, option one, your system has infinite memory. You're basically saying that your small system, let's say an ion trap, has infinite memory somehow. Option two, there's no such hidden reality. When you measure the ion, you are not revealing intrinsic properties of the ion. So we are doing real progress. My personal belief in this is that more and more people will notice that this is a too high price to pay for maintaining this notion of intrinsic reality.
Now, that's a really, really interesting analysis that you're talking about there, that you've carried out in terms of thermodynamics, because I think it really gets to the heart of the sense of what information is, or, you know, the sort of the tangible cost of information. And you're bringing together perhaps, ideas from thermodynamics that aren't usually being used to probe these kinds of situations, and saying, you know, if I want to think about this in an intuitive or a more intuitive, perhaps more common sense, classical way, I have to appreciate that I'm putting a lot of requirements on my quantum particles, that they can store and process an awful lot of information in order to be able to kind of mimic a quantum result. And, you know, you can't just say that a system can do that in a classical way without also taking into account that in classical systems, there's a thermodynamic cost, and you would expect that this kind of handling of so much information would produce a tangible effect in terms of heat that we aren't seeing in experiments.
Yeah, this is exactly the point.
No, it sounds, yeah. You know, it's a very different way of analyzing the problem. I think that's, you know, that's quite lovely.
Yeah, it's a new way, but my point is that there should be more efforts in these directions and similar directions, bringing all the pieces of physics. In this case, it was thermodynamics, but it might be geometry of whatever. And notice that your theory requires more and more stuff. So, I mean, and I love this approach. We found it. But there will be in the future, hopefully, more and more evidences pointing out that the cost of an intrinsic reality is too high, that at the end of the day, this is not going to be the right answer to the puzzle.
Thank you to Adan Kabeyo for chatting with me earlier and explaining why he believes there is no intrinsic reality at the quantum level. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to an article about his research by reporter Kate Becker. It's well worth checking out because Kabeyo also talks about the theological origins of contextuality, which was discovered in part because mathematician Ernst Becker, who was devoutly religious, wanted to know if quantum indeterminism, this idea that reality is not set before you look at it, puts a limit on God's omniscience. You'll also find a link to an article by reporter Nicola Jones about the work of Dagomir Koshlikovsky and Pavel Kruzinski, who have also been looking into quantum contextuality, which talks more about the applications of that idea for quantum computing.
Kabeyo called for other scientists to think about using other areas of physics, such as thermodynamics, to analyze quantum systems. Another of our grant winners, Jonathan Oppenheim of University College London, is taking that even further by attempting to derive the laws of a new discipline, quantum thermodynamics. I'm picking this out as a highlight from the grant round because when Oppenheim and his colleagues published their new second law of quantum thermodynamics in the journal PNAS, one of the paper's referees described the work as, and I'm quoting here, "A major contribution to our understanding of the foundations of thermodynamics, this document is likely to become a standard reference in the literature of resource theories and thermodynamics owing to its comprehensive and systematic development of so many important ideas. It has also received a huge number of citations, so it's making a real splash in the physics community."
Oppenheim spoke in depth with our reporter Colin Stewart on the podcast back in August. Here's a brief reminder, as Oppenheim explains his research program and why it has the potential to be so useful.
So we know what the laws of thermodynamics are, and they're laws which are statistical in nature. So they're valid for very, say, large gases or steam engines. They're valid for large systems or systems composed of many particles. And the question I'm interested in is, are there laws of thermodynamics at the quantum level? So if, rather than trying to look at some average laws for a gas at very large volume, we could imagine looking at just one of those gas molecules and asking, are there laws of thermodynamics which are applicable to that atom which is behaving quantum mechanically? It turned out to be quite surprising, actually, that we were able to find laws of thermodynamics at the quantum scale. And they take on forms which look very similar to the laws of thermodynamics which are applicable to large objects, and so that was quite surprising.
Why is it important to know how individual particles are behaving thermodynamically?
What we're doing at the moment is looking at smaller and smaller objects, and often at colder and colder temperatures. That's what we're doing in understanding the quantum world. We're looking at these sorts of objects in the lab, and people are constructing little nanorobots, for example, that can extract work, or in the human body, we are thinking of things as operating thermodynamically, and they're often very small systems. They're not they're not large systems, and so that's pushing you to ask these sorts of questions. But I think more interestingly, the laws of thermodynamics are probably the most broadly applicable set of laws we have in physics, because they're somehow independent of the microscopic laws of physics. You know, the second law, for example, which says that the entropy of a closed system has to always increase, or at least that's one way of formulating it. That's a law which is very robust and applies, some people think, regardless of what the laws of physics are, and it gives you an arrow of time, for example, regardless of what the underlying laws of physics are. So the laws of thermodynamics are really applicable to all branches and all areas of physics, and they're somehow more universal, and we can derive them mathematically, and they don't seem to be contingent on the particular universe we happen to be living in. So in some sense, maybe the most interesting set of physical laws we have. And so if you're interested in quantum mechanics, as I am, then you push naturally to ask that question, well, do they apply the quantum scale?
You can hear Oppenheim's full interview with Colin Stewart on the August edition of the podcast. We'll put a link up on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Now, to wrap things up, there's one major question about information that we haven't addressed. What actually is information? Brendan, you've been chatting with one of our grant winners who's been looking into this issue from a philosophical perspective.
That's right. I called philosopher Olympia Lombardi, who used her FQXI grant to help build her philosophy of physics group at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. The first thing I wanted to know from her was, what did it mean to talk about different meanings of information and why we should think about it?
As social individuals, we are very conscious about the relevance of information in our everyday world. And this has its counterpart in science. I think that it is difficult to find a scientific discipline where the notion of information is not clearly present. It is clear in physics and engineering, where the first technical concepts were coined, but the notion of information is very important also in biology, for instance, where the genetic processes are conceived in terms of encoding and transmitting genetic information, even if they are not very clear what genetic information is. And also in cognitive science, where sometimes mind processes are described as informational processes.
So we need to think about how we define information, because different ideas of information are used in so many areas of science.
Right, and in our personal and public lives as well. I asked Lombardi how to go about cataloging these different types of information.
The many different concepts are related, but related in a very loose way, following Wittgenstein's word by family resemblance. There is not a common property or feature that subsumes all the concepts, but there are many overlapping similarities that connect the different concepts in a kind of a web of meanings. For this reason, I think that the first step is to make a map of the land. I think that the first distinction to be introduced is that between a semantic and a non-semantic notion of information. Semantic information has intentionality, aboutness, that is, it is directed to other things. In this case, we can ask if a certain information is true or false, for instance. The non-semantic information, also called mathematical in general, is concerned only with quantities of information, independently of its semantic content. In the practice, in the context of mathematical information, we have to introduce a further distinction between communicational context and the computational context. Classical formalism in the communicational context is Shannon theory, with the modifications introduced by Schumacher. But in the computational context, where the relevant formal notion is algorithmic information, also called Kolmogorov complexity, the basic question is the ultimate compression of individual messages, the minimal number of bits from which a particular message can effectively be reconstructed. This is not communication, but compression of information. This is not, of course, a complete classification of the meanings of information. This is only a beginning of a map of the land.
Okay, so information can be semantic or mathematic.
Right, and even communicational or computational. And then, does the information just impart knowledge, or is it a physical quantity like energy? I asked Lombardi if she thought one of the categories she described to me was most fundamental. She said no. In her pluralist view, they are all distinct and important.
According to this view, we should begin by a formalism, say, for instance, Shannon theory. In this mathematical context, Shannon information is a merely formal concept without any semantic content. The second step is to consider the application of the formalism, and the interpretations of the formalism led to different non-merely formal concepts of information that, according to us, are not rival to each other. For instance, the epistemic view may be useful in psychology and in cognitive science. In turn, information can be interpreted in terms of thermodynamic entropy in physics. In molecular biology, information may be conceived as what is carried by DNA sequence and that contains the instructions to build an organism, and so on. Our main point is that we don't need to consider that one of the interpretations is the best or the most fundamental concept of information, since each one is useful and appropriate in a certain domain.
Thank you to Olympia Lombardi for speaking with Brendan earlier. So there we have it. We now know what information is,
how information can help bring together quantum theory and thermodynamics,
how information might be used to rule out the idea that there's a concrete reality hiding underneath quantum measurements,
how the ability to process information could define what life is,
how an artificial space-time could reveal information about quantum gravity,
how our 3D universe could be a hologram encoded as information on a 2D quantum chip.
And we're still puzzling over what happens to information, or indeed to people, that might fall into a black hole.
Not bad for $3 million. And that's only a selection of the research funded during FQXI's Physics of Information grant round. For more information,
groan.
For more details about other FQXI-funded research, head to www.fqxi.org/community, where you'll find articles and podcast packages about quantum cybernetics,
solar system-sized experiments,
neutron star-mimicking nanowires,
the limits on God's knowledge,
the search for unsolvable problems,
a derivation of quantum theory from a purity principle,
an investigation into electron identity,
the emergence of reality from quantum complex networks,
tests for theories that are spookier than quantum mechanics,
an attempt to quantify Occam's razor,
and a journey into the heart of darkness, the core of a black hole.
Phew, that's all we have time for today. Thank you again to Donald Maroff, Arden Cabello, and Olympia Lombardi, who joined us for this edition. And to all the contributors to our previous podcasts, including those we heard from again today. Mark Van Ramsdonk, Sorin Parawanu, Julian Barber, Suzanne Still, and Jonathan Oppenheim.
You can find out more about our current grant round on Physics of the Observer on the website www.fqxi.org. You can also reach us on Twitter at FQXI or by email at podcast@fqxi.org.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
I'm off to a mirror universe in which time runs in the opposite direction to record this podcast again, backwards.
And since I don't have time to fully assess whether that's my cat, Puffy the Cat, lurking over there, or a Bengal tiger, I think I had better start to run.